From the Sky News Centre at 6, the brother of a man who was poisoned by a nerve agent in Wiltshire says he's quite sure he's just an innocent victim. Charlie Rowley and Dawn Sturgess are both in a critical condition after being found on Saturday in Amesbury. Both were exposed to Novichok. Detectives are keeping an open mind and think they may have picked up a container used in an attack on a former Russian spy and his daughter in March. Matthew Rowley desperately wants to see his sibling.
The police said they were going to take me down there so I can go and visit him, but visiting is a very limited thing at the moment because he's in a critical condition, he's in a big bubble.
A 16-year-old boy has been remanded in custody after appearing in court accused of raping and murdering a girl. 6-year-old Alicia MacPhail was found in Woodland on the Isle of Bute on Monday morning. It's been revealed Donald Trump will be kept well outside London for most of his visit to the UK. It means he'll avoid protesters expected to gather in the centre of the city next week, but he will meet the Queen at Windsor Castle. A former senior aide to David Cameron insists the former Prime Minister hasn't criticised Theresa May's vision for Brexit. Craig Oliver has denied claims her predecessor and Boris Johnson agreed her plan is the worst of both worlds. And France are into the World Cup semi-finals for the first time since 2006. They progress to the last four in Russia with a 2-0 victory over Uruguay. Brazil take on Belgium in an hour. The winner of that match will play the French next. That's the latest. I'm Victoria Lawrence.
And BCFM Radio's from bcfmradio.com.
It's Friday, 6 o'clock. Welcome to BCFM's Politics Show. I'm Tony Gosling, helping us review this week's news as Labour councillor for Lockleaze, Estella Ticknor. Old Labour Oxford economist Martin Summers is here too. After the 7 o'clock news, Putin strikes again in Amesbury. At least that's what we're supposed to believe, with the key witnesses being alleged hard drug addicts. So why did it take 4 days to change from a routine bad batch of hard drugs as the Met's terrorism command took over to an act of international sabotage by Putin? And NATO's biennial summit next week in Brussels, what diplomatic nukes will Donald Trump be dropping? And we have his visiting the Queen next week on the auspicious date of Friday the 13th, followed on Monday week by the Trump-Putin-Helsinki love-in. All the warmongers, particularly the Israelis and Theresa May's controllers at the deep state, they will be dreading that. And carried over from last week, the human cattle, the slave trade. Liverpool, Bristol and London pioneered the horrific triangular trade to Africa and the Caribbean with all the blood carefully washed off the decks before the merchants of death returned to Bristol. But where did we get the business model from? The Italians played a key role, first the Roman Empire, then the shadowy merchants of the Venice city-state. Plus Martin's chance to take us on a tour of the world's hotspots in the second hour after seven. On to our news review in a minute, but first Bristol's two-weekend weather forecast from theweatheroutlook.com. Tonight, lows of 16 Celsius and dry. St. Paul's Carnival Day, that's tomorrow, Saturday. Highs of 29 Celsius. Gosh, probably looks like the hottest day of the year. That's going to be an interesting combination. Sunny and a bit more cloud, though, on Sunday over the weekend. Next week, highs of 29 also, mainly sunny, cooling down a bit as the week progresses. Next weekend, that's the 14th and 15th of July, temperatures lowering a bit to 27, mainly sunny, though, still. That was Bristol's two-weekend weather forecast from theweatheroutlook.com. So, helping us review this week's news is Labour councillor for Lockleaze, Estella Ticknor. Hi, Estella, welcome to the Politics Show.
Thank you. Hello.
First of all, tell us a bit about Lockleaze. There's only one councillor. Most of the areas in the,
no,
in the city.
No, there's two councillors.
Oh, are there? Right. Okay.
Oh, yes. Yes, there's two councillors.
Okay, so I must have misread that. But yeah. What?
So, my fellow councillor is Jill Kirk. Okay.
And what party?
Labour. We're both Labour.
Both Labour.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
So tell us what's going on up there. New houses being built.
New houses being built. There's going to be nearly 1,000 new houses built in
private,
Leeds.
Or are they private, affordable?
It's going to be a mixture council. With a very strong emphasis on affordable housing.
But affordable doesn't always actually mean affordable.
No, but you know that Paul Smith, the Cabinet Member for Housing, is very hot on this topic, and you're absolutely right that there's affordable and affordable. He's going to make sure there's going to be a mix of council housing, social housing, and private housing. He doesn't want to build kind of separate ghettos, as it were, of council housing, but he's very keen to make sure we have more council housing built in the area because there's a crying need for it. When I knock on doors, I find multi-generational households, you know, grandma, parents and children who need somewhere to live, and they say, why can't my son or daughter get a house in Lockleaze? And I say, that's a very good question.
So the lack of housing, is that caused by immigration?
No, it's not caused by immigration, no. It's caused by the fact that we haven't built any houses in Lockleaze for over 10 years.
Well, where's all these extra people come from then? And we're getting 300,000 a year, I think up until last year anyway, people coming into Britain.
They aren't all coming to Lockleaze. It is an increasingly diverse area, but that's not the cause of a problem, that's a consequence, okay? Policies. So the problem really is, we've had right to buy, Lockleaze was a big council estate, as you probably know, built in the post-war years. Houses have been bought up, sometimes by private landlords, and something like a third of what had been council housing in Lockleaze is now owned by private owners. And a lot of that is increasingly what's called HMOs, it's houses in multiple occupation. So you've got various groups of people living in those houses, either in sort of bedsits or studios. And that's really putting a squeeze on local families who can't afford to buy those properties, can't afford to rent those properties. They're being rented out at something like £1,000 for a time for a month. That's way beyond a lot of the families of Lockleaze.
Okay, so of all these new houses being built in Lockleaze, how many are social housing?
At the moment, it's likely to be about 30%, something like that. But that's not actually confirmed yet, okay? It hasn't even gone through planning. But that's what we're looking at.
Well, I'm just wondering how many of the people who are camping on College Green are going to be able to take up any of these homes, because we've got 20 or so people who have just moved from various parks around the city where they've been evicted by the council.
Indeed.
Onto College Green. Now, this is the sort of thing that happens when governments fail. You know, it's the sort of thing that's happened in places like Mexico, in the United States, where people are just literally left with nowhere to live, no chance of getting a job, to get enough money to find somewhere to live, and then they have to live in tents. It really is, you know, the bottom rung of the ladder, and you're not going to just lie out. You need, even if it's just a £5, £10 tent, just something to stick over your head. So why is it that the council has been moving them out of other parks? I mean, do you blame them for going on to College Green?
No, I don't blame them. But obviously, we're trying to deal with it in as humane a way as possible. There's a balance, isn't there, between making sure that people actually have somewhere decent to live and actually dealing with a long-standing systemic problem. And really, the tents are the sort of tip of the iceberg of a problem I've just been identifying, which is that we haven't been building enough houses in this country for over 10 years. It's national government which has actually caused the problem.
But you don't have enough temporary accommodation for people, obviously.
No, we don't. That's quite right.
But so what are you doing to build that?
Well, I've just told you, we are building houses as quickly as we can. I mean, Paul Smith is actually taking action to make sure that people do find decent quality temporary accommodation. Sometimes they don't want to live in it, and that's been a bit of a problem as well, making sure people actually are suitably housed. But it's a long-term problem and it can't be changed overnight. We're doing our very best to make sure that we actually do find decent housing for people. But just to get planning permission through can take several months. Then you actually have to find the people to build the houses. So it will be changed by 2020, but unfortunately, we can't change it overnight.
So where should people go if they haven't got anywhere to live?
Well, then? I think that's a massive dilemma, I know, and it's not something I have an easy answer for. I wish I did. And I don't blame people. For example, we up in Lockleaze, on the Romney House site, which will eventually be new housing, there are actually people living in vans there. And we've actually allowed that. We've worked with St Mungo's to ensure that it's a safe space for them. All those people are in work. They all have jobs. So we're not talking about people who are, reliant on the state, but what they can't do is find the money to put together to get a deposit on a house or to rent somewhere. So at the moment, what we're trying to do is support them as much as we can. But it's a systemic problem which we're just beginning to try to deal with, and we're talking about at least 20 years of not thinking about that and not addressing it.
"We are not targeting Bristol's most vulnerable," screams the headline from the Bristol Post. They like to call it Bristol Live, I think, on the Bristol internet Live, these days. Bristol City Council launches a van dweller and rough sleeper consultation. Now, why can't the council just get on and find places for these people to live? If necessary, use empty buildings, convert them. Obviously, that's what's needed. You don't need a consultation, because actually my experience in consultations is most of the time you find what you wanted to find in the first place.
Well, first of all, Bristol Council doesn't own all the property in the city. It owns some property.
It owns a tremendous amount of property.
Well, it owns a lot, but not all of that is suitable to convert. And often people say, well, why don't you just convert office blocks? Often they don't have sufficient toilets, they don't have washing facilities or kitchen facilities. And you're effectively saying that people are going to have to kind of live in dormitory type accommodation. So what we're trying to do is to make the kind of accommodation best that you or I might be happy to live in as much as possible. You can't simply convert property. It's not a simple matter.
When's it going to be sorted, Estella?
Sorry?
When is it going to be sorted?
It's as soon as possible, I hope. I can't give you a date or a time. It's not my personal responsibility. I do my best to support, you know, the council and the mayor in trying to solve the problem.
Well, it's not through lack of money, is it? Because
it's partly lack of resources.
Well, I was going to say, the city council, we're told, due to some leaks to the BBC, broke its own rules and spent £2 million on interim staff. The figures which were leaked to the BBC and the Bristol Post show the authority spent nearly £2 million with the recruitment agency Penna in the financial year 20... Well, it's up to this April. That's a lot of money on senior staff.
Yes, it
is. And it's because they were temporary. Why not just employ the right people and employ them given permanent contracts?
Well,
then you don't have to pay them so much.
No,
and
well,
you don't have to pay a middleman or middlewoman, whoever it is, to outsource your staffing for you.
There's been a massive loss of staff at the City Council. That's partly because we've had to make major cuts to staffing. And as you probably know, staff is the largest cost of councils. There has been a lot of churn in the top and middle management area. I hope it's been stabilised now. I'm certainly the last person who would wish to spend that sort of money on temporary staff or on consultants. That's not the best way to spend our money. I hope it's much more stable now than it has been over the last year or so.
Well, Green Councillor for Clifton, Paula O'Rourke, she's pointed out that you've got a 10-to-1 voluntary pay pledge, which states those on the highest salaries should be paid no more than 10 times more than those on the lowest wages.
Yeah,
well, even
that's
right. Sounds like quite a lot, but because of these middlemen, this company, the
recruitment company.
Recruitment firm, you're paying quite a lot more than
it's not a situation I would wish to be in, I have to say.
But there is money, seems to be, for that sort of thing, but not for sorting out the homeless. What about also, there's another thing that I spotted today, looking earlier on at some of the stories this week, and that is this congestion charge. It's almost like, what sort of congestion charge do we want? Not do we want one, do we need one? I mean, I've been talking about this for years, saying I wonder if there's any real effort being made to sort out the city's congestion. Because if you don't sort it out, you can impose a congestion charge, which is a brand new tax, money from nowhere, and also somebody like Serco or whoever it is, Capita, they have another name, I think, but it's, you cannot pronounce on the radio. can just make a fortune out of what we need to do every day, which is drive in, and it's a way of punishing people for using their cars, mainly because the buses aren't very good and the public transport is so hopeless.
Well, Bristol doesn't own or run its buses, unfortunately. I wish that we did, quite frankly. I mean, I've just struggled to get here this evening. Congestion is terrible tonight. There have been a load of road closures. The heat probably doesn't help. I mean, but Bristol's geography doesn't help, actually. I mean, it's a city which is built with, you know, it's got a gorge on one side, it's got a river, it's got the Cumberland Basin. All of that means that the traffic is trying to get through a tight sort of corridor in the city centre and back out again. You can't change that very easily. I mean, with congestion charges, they can be controversial for sure, but it's worked quite well in parts of London. I wouldn't wish to sort of blanketly say it's a bad thing.
It's going to happen then, is it?
I mean, I don't know. I can assure
you. You sound to me like you're in the know more than most of us.
No, I'm a humble backbench councillor and I have absolutely no
idea. But you're in the know more than most of us. I think over the years there's been a drift towards this is going to definitely happen. And what incentive is there on a council that could have a massive new income stream through a congestion charge to sort out congestion? I mean, Metrobus is a joke, isn't it? It's, I mean, he's done virtually nothing to sort out congestion. Actually, it made it for several years of construction far, far worse in the centre.
That's
and
true.
Around Temple Meads, etc. So,
it's the Metro bus is a kind of bit of a camel, isn't it? You know, a kind of horse designed by committee. It's not necessarily the best solution to Bristol's transport problems. Ideally, we'd have an integrated transport system where you and things like an underground system, for example, trams,
is that real?
Decent buses.
Is that real?
It's not real at the moment with the kind of finances that we have. I would not say.
Have you looked at the water table around here?
Yeah, I know. Of course, that's true. Of course,
well,
that's true.
We're quite low down.
Yeah.
Actually, London is too, isn't it?
Yeah, exactly. So. It seems to me we've got to be ambitious about transport in this city, and we really spent a long time not being very ambitious, or at least scrapping schemes which might have been good but didn't happen in the end. And I do recognise that that's a problem.
This obsession with cars drives me mad.
Well,
know?
Bristol's got something like the it's highest
not just Bristol,
per capita
is it, of course.
Head of population of
it's
car
Europe.
Ownership.
It started, where did it start? Come on, you know this. With Nazi Germany building their autobahns in the 1930s,
it's all their fault, yeah.
so they could move their tanks around the country as quick as possible. They were getting ready for their blitzkrieg. Then it was all picked up by the Americans, and they built freeways. And then in the 1960s, we decided, oh, we don't really need railways anymore. We closed those down. And this is the oil industry really making policy, isn't it?
Well, I don't think so, no.
The fact that there's so many cars
actually,
around.
My understanding is that car ownership has gone down in this country.
Really?
And certainly anecdotally, a lot more of my students at UWE are coming by public transport rather than by car. It's clearly not going to happen overnight. But Bristol has a particular problem because of its narrow roads, congested streets, and the high level of car ownership. And I would agree that's a problem we have to try and deal with. But that can't be something the council can solve on its own.
But the oil industry, no, they're not sort of behind this lack of public transport and marvellous, you know, the car is the way to do it because people get fed up sitting in queues at bus stops and railway stations.
Well, they do.
The road lobby, it's called, isn't it?
Yeah,
I mean, you know, they make money from building roads. Yeah. They own and run the transport, a lot of the road lorry transport, and they sell oil, and the government does very, very nicely out of oil, doesn't it? Out of their fuel tax revenue. Anyway,
that's not something city council controls.
Obviously. No, no, but I mean, surely there's something that they can do about buses, isn't there?
Well, I mean,
something you can do about the buses?
I wish there was something I could do about buses. I mean, one of the things that we've been doing is working with First Bus. But bear in mind that we actually have less money to spend on things like subsidised routes now. We've had to cut the number of routes that the council subsidises because of austerity.
Well, wonderful, because this is something that came up at Prime Minister's Questions. Actually, Jeremy Corbyn was accused, I think, one of the witty later questioners, saying, "Oh, you don't have any discussion about buses at Prime Minister's Questions." For years, and then seven questions all at once.
Yes,
so anyway,
I know, that's right, all coming
anyway,
at once.
So let's have a listen to.
There's a bit of a crisis in bus usage, it seems, across the whole country. So clearly, you know, buses are not the only answer. We need to have a proper integrated transport policy.
Okay, let's have a listen to PMQs now.
Mr. Speaker, it'll be a Labour government that saves the bus industry and a Labour government that gives free fares to under 26-year-olds. Mr. Speaker, the truth is, since deregulation, fares have risen faster than inflation, ridership has fallen, and these private bus monopolies have made a profit since 2010 of £3.3 billion. That's what the Tories give you in public transport. The government has given Metro mayors the powers to franchise and regulate to secure better services. Why won't the government extend that power to all local authorities?
To the Right Honourable Gentleman that, of course, the local authorities do have some responsibilities and capabilities in relation to subsidising bus routes and fares. And yes, we have given those powers to the Metro mayors. But can I also say to the Right Honourable Gentleman, he talked a little earlier about reference what was happening in the Northern Powerhouse and the Midlands Engine. I'll tell him what's happening in the Northern Powerhouse and the Midlands Engine. More investment in our public transport, more investment in our roads, more investment in the infrastructure that brings jobs to people in the north and people across the Midlands.
Well, that's Prime Minister Theresa May answering, at least trying to answer some questions. And actually, at some point there, she did, I think she said that the local authorities do have some responsibility for public transport.
Yeah, very limited. As I said, we can subsidise a few bus routes, basically. Well, that's the case in Bristol because First Bus and other private companies run most of the routes. So we do have very limited powers in Bristol to do very much about it. I would like us to see a national government which gave local authorities much greater powers. I used to live in Birmingham. Years ago, we used to have West Midlands Passenger Transport Executive, which was responsible for ensuring we had a properly integrated system in which trains and bus routes actually married up with each other, and you could go anywhere by bus very cheaply.
Well, let's do that here.
That would be great, wouldn't it?
It would be. Maybe the Metro Mayor. I mean, this is the thing that annoyed me about that Metro Mayor business is that they just basically extended the boundary around Bristol out into the sort of leafy suburbs where the Tory voters were, and then they said, oh well, let's have another mayor that includes all those areas too. So it was almost bound to be a Tory, but actually Labour did quite well. Amazingly,
we did do quite well, but I have to say I'm not in favour of Metro mayors. It just has another layer of power with very little sense of what he's responsible for. Hardly anyone in this city really knows either who the Metro Mayor is, what he does, what his responsibilities are.
Well, we've had him on here a couple of times, Tim Bowles, but it does seem that there's more and more of these sort of LEP, Local Enterprise Partnership, Metro Mayor people, various, who are spending central government money around here, but they're actually not very accountable.
Well, they're not at all. Most people have no idea what the LEP is, what it stands for, who's on it, what kind of money they have to spend.
Well, they seem to give themselves quite a lot of money. I don't know if you'd noticed that, the universities and the Western College and people like that who are on there, they actually, you work at the university.
I work at UWE, I couldn't possibly comment.
Well, tell us a bit about what you do up at UWE.
I teach film studies at UWE. Yeah.
And what is that? I mean, gosh, that's a big subject.
That's not filmmaking, I hasten to add, okay? I don't teach people how to make films. But it's really kind of a history of film. I specialise in British cinema and also music and cinema. So it's a whole history of kind of film movements and traditions and thinking a little bit about how film works as a medium.
Well, as we're letting our hair down a little bit for St Paul's Carnival, give us a few of your favourite films. Tell us, you know, something that we might have missed, particularly from British films. I mean, there's so much out there, and particularly nowadays, you can get quite a lot of stuff that you won't see on the telly. You'll get it somewhere else. I mean, maybe you can get a DVD of it, you can get a download of it. So come on, let's have a couple of films.
My mind's gone a blank.
Like.
Thanks a lot.
Oh, no. Well, I'm giving you a little bit of time there to have a think.
I'll tell you one thing I am interested in. I'm quite interested in Carry On films, actually. And I've written about Hattie Jakes, the figure of Hattie Jakes, who's a really interesting actress, got very typecast by appearing in Carry On films. But the thing that most interested me about her was that you probably know her as Matron, you know. She came to stand for the National Health Service. And it was a kind of mix of fantasy and fiction that people started to talk as though Hattie Jakes ran the National Health Service rather than the real National Health Service. So she's a really kind of powerful figure, I think, in the British imaginary. People like the idea of a kind of bustling matron making things work properly, telling off those naughty men. And I was really fascinated by the way in which those Carry On films often have those kind of archetypes that we have a really strong sense of identity with. They're often terrible films in lots of ways, really bad, corny jokes, but they do say something about British character. And that's one of the things I'm quite interested in.
They certainly do. what would you also, I mean, there's quite a lot of us, I suppose, that, you know, maybe I'm in my 50s, people nowadays look at films and think, well, what on earth are they doing? Because there's no I mean, I don't find very many entertaining, well, easy to watch films at all. Yeah, in the 1940s, 50s, 60s, they were being churned out 19 to the dozen.
Yeah.
Now I look at something, I think, well, the special effects obviously cost about £10 million, but there's no good story.
Yeah.
There's not much of a story. So how has the film industry changed?
Well, it's changed radically, as you say. Actually, the British film...
Well, so as we see it, it has. Yeah. But what's been going on behind the
scenes? The British film industry is doing extremely well. That's not the same as British
cinema.
Does
it still exist?
Oh, well, that's what I'm saying. So actually, places like Pinewood Studios are extremely well, making basically, you know, conglomerate international films like the Bond franchise. I mean, they have the best skills, the best expertise and technical knowledge. Those films are made in the UK. They ostensibly have a British theme and topic, but are they British cinema? It's quite questionable whether they are, because in many respects it's a globalised franchise, which is basically funded by American money. So for people working in British cinema, the question of what a British film is actually quite a tricky anyone. So there are rules. British Film Institute, for example, which currently does the sort of public funding for British cinema, has quite clear rules about it's got to have British characters, British themes and topics, and it's got to be clearly located in the UK. But even then, it's often made for a kind of global or American audience. So, you know, their idea of Britain is often England land and Scotland.
But
you
there
know.
Was this battle that took place in the 60s and 70s, wasn't
yes.
there, with J. Arthur Rank, and he was making films, but he also owned a lot of cinemas.
That's right.
And the Americans refused to, I think it was they owned Odeon and various other chains, refused to show his films. So there was he had to maintain his own
Well, Odeon
cinema.
Odeon was a British chain, actually, started by Oscar Deutsch in Birmingham, interestingly. But you're right that the Americans have a stranglehold on distribution and exhibition of films very often.
So you can make a fantastic film, but
nobody will see it. And that's still a problem today. And that's why places like Watershed Cinema in Bristol are so important. It's one of the few places you can see a British film.
I mean, they could show some decent films in the evenings. They seem to show daytime films on the TV, but not really much in the evenings at all. I mean, Freeview, why even bother, I think, sometimes?
Yeah. Well, actually, I'm a fan of talking pictures.
We're getting nods around the studio here, yes.
It's
okay.
Kind of wall-to-wall British cinema, and you get to see films you haven't seen for years. Really excellent British films. So, and it's a Bristol-based organisation as well.
Okay,
you should be able to get it on your Freeview box.
Well, we are letting our hair down here because it's St Paul's Carnival, and this is the sort of thing that I'd love to hear more of, both on the radio and in the carnival, which is really rather sharp-edge political rap. And this, I think, is, or I hope it anyway, it's Chili B from 1994.
10 white from the Caucasian Times. Are you a drug dealer? And if so, why?
Gerald Hawksworth, White Man's Gazette. Why are our prisons so overpopulated with black men?
Excuse me, right here. Excuse me, yes. Peter Clanning's The White Street Journal. Why is it that most violent crimes are committed by black American males?
Excuse me.
Answer the question, please.
I'm just a young black man trying to be paid so I could be like the other man and have it made. Life in the city is rough. Welfare don't pay enough. A good job for the young black man is a buffer. In order to survive, somebody's gotta suffer. I only rob the rich to feed my family, and now they call me a menace to society. I'm a menace to society. 'Cause I'm a menace to society. 'Cause I'm a menace to society. Good job at a place like the steel mill sounds good, but I make more money from my neighborhood, and my neighborhood keeps both pockets fat, so I keep going back. That's where the money's at. Black from hell, that's who I am and where I've been. Task force rolls by, I grin. Then I commence to collecting my mail, hoping and praying not to end up in a jail cell. Mama's whole life is dependent on me, 'cause it's hard to survive on AFDC. Food stamps, free milk and cheese. When I think about it, hit another liquor store and yell freeze. Everybody on the floor. Then I empty the cash drawer and run for the front door. This is the reason why, you see, I'm a menace to society. I'm a menace to society. I'm called a menace to society. I'm a menace to society.
Furthermore, I feel the needs of the black community has yet to be met. Our federal government and its corporate allies have the means necessary to put an end to this political oppression, which continues to keep the African American struggling for survival.
The streets are unsafe. With a brother like me, see, I take your car, VCR, and your TV. I drive away singing songs on your radio. My conscience starts talking to me, saying way to go. 'Cause once again, my family could be fed, the rent is paid. So we can rest ahead. I look forward to a brighter day. All I could do is pray and hope and pray. Task force is brutal, and I'm angry. The DA sees a brother like me and wants to hang me. Run across a brother like me and can't hack and jack a young punk quick. for a Raiders jacket. I run the streets just to get my grit on, so my family can have some decent furniture to sit on. So don't try to tell me how to be, cause I'ma just be me, sign menace to society. I'm a menace to society. I'm a menace to society. Yes, I'm a menace to society. I'm a menace to society. My homie's in the grave, result of a drive-by. I hate it cause I know it makes my mother cry. Her whole life is a nervous wreck, and I'm a social reject trying to get a paycheck. Society is giving birth to a fool like me. I'm a T-H-R-E-A-T, so they label me lazy. They say I'm uneducated, violent, and crazy. But I'm a young black man trying to be paid, so I can be like the other man and have it made. Life in the city is rough. Welfare don't quite pay enough. A job for the young black man is a cover. In order to survive, somebody's gotta suffer. They say I'm a menace to society, but society's a menace to me. I'm a menace to society. I'm a menace to society. They say I'm a menace to society. Society's a menace to me.
Well, the year's 1994. That's a terrific little, I think it was an EP actually, on the old-fashioned vinyl. The that's Chili B, Menace to Society. Estelle, are you going to be booging on down tomorrow?
Definitely booging on down, yes, yeah. The only thing is I've got to go and do some stuff in my ward actually in the morning, unfortunately, but I'll try and pop down in the afternoon and.
Why has it been so long since we've had a St Paul's Carnival?
Well, as you probably know, there were all sorts of problems with the old Carnival Committee, and
apparently they weren't up to the job.
Well, that's what I was told. Yeah,
I mean, this, you know, there's a lot of people in St Paul's that were saying, well, actually, this is really a city council takeover. They're pulling the funding along with the Arts Council in order to say who's going to run the carnival. Actually, we want to run it.
No, that's absolutely not true. In fact, the council doesn't run the carnival. The Carnival Committee runs the carnival, and it's a brand new committee. They've worked incredibly hard over the last 18 months to get this one ready. And you know, there were issues about the management of it. It wasn't really being run terribly well. So, but the council has not had a direct involvement in that. We've left the Carnival Committee to actually plan it. And as I understand it, they've put an awful lot of work into planning the events effectively, making sure there's stuff for families, for example, you know, controlling things like drinking so everyone can enjoy themselves, and working closely with the police and the council on that kind of management of events stuff, which is really hard when you're doing things in the street. It's not like doing something in an arena or a kind of enclosed space.
Martin, we should really bring you in. Sorry, it's been a while, yeah. Actually. You've been sitting there patiently. But, I mean, you went to the... Obviously, most people have been to the previous carnival. Mm-hmm. What was wrong with it? Anything in your view?
Well, I think, as I understand it, the police weren't happy with it. And don't forget that the police have to police it, and that's got to be
funded.
But
the police don't have a veto on things like this, do
they?
No, but
at the same time, there's an issue. You remember the Green Gathering was closed down some years ago because they couldn't pay...
It was a political intervention,
because they couldn't pay for the policing of it.
No, that wasn't why. No, you're completely wrong about that. Right. That was because that there was some sort of box hadn't been ticked on one of the traffic closure orders, and the police just pulled the rug out underneath. Yeah, they were committed to massive spending on the festival. And then we're told a day before, 2 days before it was due to start, no, you can't have a festival.
Well, I'm
so the police can pull the rung out from underneath festival organisers if they are so minded to. So let's hope that wasn't part of this. But anyway, so would you think the policing was wrong, or the old carnival was not so good, or what?
Well, inevitably, when you've got a large crowd like that, there's going to be some bother. And sometimes some people just say, well, let's not have it because there's going to be some bother. And of course, I don't really understand all the background to it. I'll be honest, I'm not been involved
anyway,
in
while we were listening, like while we were listening to good old Chili B there, we were chatting, weren't we, about the film study stuff. You mentioned a film called Some People.
Some People, yes.
Estella, yeah.
This film was made in Bristol in 1962, and it was made partly in Lock Leeds, my ward. And it was a film which came out of what's called the New Wave, which is films made between the late 50s and early 1960s, yeah. Which were about kind of working class life, ordinary people's lives. You probably know Saturday Night and Sunday Morning, Look Back in Anger, Taste of Honey.
Oh, these Sheila Delaney, fantastic.
Absolutely. Yeah. Now, these are incredibly successful films, had a really strong sense of British identity, but they're also very much part of that moment in the post-war period when there's a new kind of respect for working class identity and lives. And for the first time, ordinary people get to be on screen. And Some People was a kind of mix of new wave social realism and a sort of musical. So it's about a gang of tearaway teenagers who, yeah, they're doing the ton up down the portway, very interestingly, get up before the beat, get their motorbikes taken away, so they don't know what else to do with themselves, get together in a youth club and start playing musical instruments and start singing and dancing together. And it's all overseen by the benign figure of Kenneth Moore, whom you may remember, quite an important British film star of the 50s and 60s, who plays a church warden, a very middle-class church warden, who actually lives in Clifton.
So can we actually get to see this film?
Well, you can. It's just been, it is available on DVD.
Okay.
Interestingly, we had a screening at Watershed a couple of months ago, and I was on a panel to talk about it. And the screening actually included people who'd performed in the film, including some local people from Lock Leeds who'd been extras. They'd been young kids at the time, they were in a school choir or something
like
that.
I'm going to come back to the original question, which is, back in those days, yeah, it seemed very easy somehow to get local people who just had an idea for a film to turn it into a feature film, actually to actually get films off the ground. Nowadays, it's an incredibly complicated process, a commissioning process that's millions of pounds involved, and yet actually the equipment, the cameras, etc., are much cheaper and much more available. No, so what's happened?
Well, it's the thing we talked about before. Actually, people do make films actually very cheaply, and in fact, we've got a whole range of sort of funding streams. Things like, you know, Film 4, for example, the BFI. The difficulty still remains how you get those films out there being on screens, because most of the cinemas in this country are part of kind of multinational corporations, you know, if you go to The View or something like that. So that's one of the big problems. But there are lots of really interesting films being made.
The thing to do is make a film about how evil these multinational corporations are.
Well, that's been done, yeah.
Dare them to show it's the corporation thing, isn't it? Anyway, look, we were hearing from Chili B. We've also been talking about some of the problems to do with homelessness in the city. And we had a horrific little episode this week with the Work and Pensions Secretary, Esther McVeigh. Here she is talking at Prime Minister's Questions. In fact, actually, it's not her. It's a question asked about her at PMQs on Wednesday.
Marsha de Cordova.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. This morning, the head of the National Audit Office took the unprecedented step of writing an open letter to the Secretary of State for Work and Pensions, setting out how she has misled Parliament in three respective statements. She has made over universal credit. The ministerial code is very clear that, and I quote, it is of paramount importance that ministers give accurate and truthful information to Parliament, correcting any inadvertent error at the earliest opportunity. Ministers who knowingly mislead Parliament will be expected to offer their resignation to the Prime Minister. Has she?
As the Honourable Lady said, it's very clear that ministers should correct the record in Parliament, and the Welfare Secretary will be correcting the record, as I believe she has advised you, Mr. Speaker, after PMQs at the dispatch box.
Well, that's appalling. She should lose her job, basically. She's lied to Parliament. Quite apart from the disaster that is universal credit, as it is being rolled out at the moment, Esther McVeigh is clearly untrustworthy.
Well, we've had several people in the Cabinet who seem to be lying. I mean, one is Boris Johnson when he lied about Porton Down, saying that this was from Russia, this Novichok, the original Skripal one, and then it was revealed that actually, in fact, it took the director of the Porton Down Chemical Weapons establishment to come on the telly and say, actually, no, we can't pin it down to Russia. Mm. And so he'd lied. Mm. I mean, this is starting to get a bit of a habit. Also people in the Cabinet just totally contradicting the Prime Minister saying, well, you know, she's silly, you know, and she doesn't know what she's doing, this kind of thing. It's a bit of a lack of discipline.
Well, they're squabbling heavily amongst themselves.
But hang on, the same exact thing's happening in the Labour shadow cabinet, isn't it?
No, I think actually it's a sea of tranquility compared to the Tories at the moment. And we know that Boris Johnson, for example, lied on his famous battle bus for, you know, about the money that was supposed to be coming from the National Health Service if we left the EU. That is clearly and patently not going to happen. So he's got form.
Anyway, Esther McVeigh then, after Prime Minister's question, made her statement in the House of Commons about why she lied.
Mr. Speaker, while speaking in Parliament in answer to questions on the NAO report into universal credit, I mistakenly said that the NAO had asked for the rollout of universal credit to continue at a faster rate and to be speeded up. In fact, the NAO did not say that, Mr. Speaker, and I want to apologise.
I do think this is rather unseemly.
And I want to apologise to you and the House for inadvertently misleading you. What I'd meant to say was that the NAO had said that there was no practical alternative to continuing with universal credit. We adopt a test-and-learn approach to the rollout of universal credit, which the NAO says mainly follows good practice, and therefore the point I was trying to make was that the calls from the party opposite to pause it seemed to fly in the face of those particular conclusions. As you know, Mr. Speaker, I asked you yesterday if I could come to the House to correct the record. I believe it is right that as a minister I should come and correct the record, and I therefore hope you will accept my apology. Whilst I'm here, Mr. Speaker, with regard to the other issues raised in the letter sent today by the NAO. The NAO contacted my office at the end of last week and we are working on setting up a meeting. And with regard to the NAO report not taking into account the impact of the recent changes to UC, I still maintain this is the case, such as housing benefit run-on and 100% advances and the removal of waiting days. The impact of these changes are still being felt and therefore by definition couldn't have been fully taken into account by the NAO report. I hope that clarifies the position.
Well, it's quite clear that the universal credit is basically losing money. So the National Audit Office has made it absolutely clear that the whole project is basically a huge waste of money, apart from anything else. It's based on the persecution of the undeserving poor and all the rest of it, but it's basically big lemon.
So why are they doing this? I mean, if it's actually costing more than the previous system is, Martin, as seems to be being implied here. And also, really, there should be some sort of, I would have thought, reaction, you know, honest reaction from Esther McVeigh when she's told, halt this right now.
Well, because of the electoral system, winning general elections in this country means winning the satellite towns around London, and that means winning, you know, several hundred thousand voters decided, and the Labour Party, other parties, they've done focus groups for these people. These people quite like the idea that poor people are given a hard time, and that's why you had the right wing of the Labour Party going along with this stuff, and we need to change the electoral system so that every vote counts.
Well, maybe you need to get your own house in order in the Labour Party, eh? Well, also, Frank Field, bless him, he responded to Esther McVeigh's statement just after Prime Minister's questions.
Frank Field. We're grateful for the Secretary of State's apology again for one aspect of where the Comptroller and Auditor General criticised her behaviour for dissembling. The two others are: the Secretary of State told the House that the Auditor General had advised her to roll out faster, where he told her to pause so that vulnerable claimants wouldn't be hit further, and that secondly, that the universal credit is working is not proven, as she said, that 40% of claimants find themselves in financial difficulty, 25% can't make a claim online, 20% overall, but two-thirds of disabled claimants are not paid on time and in full. Hence the demand of the Controller and Auditor General, our big regulator in this country, for her to pause the universal credit programme.
Yeah, but she's not said she'll do that. Maybe there's be all sorts of other pressure on her to do so. The problem here, of course, is it leaves the most vulnerable in society and the jobless with just simply no money whatsoever, Estella.
Yes, I agree.
And food banks, I mean, that's a whole other aspect to all of this.
Well, we're already seeing levels of destitution and poverty that we haven't seen in this country since before the welfare state was invented, actually, in the late 1940s. I'm extremely concerned about the impact of universal credit in my ward. I know that it's going to be confusing to people, but it's basically intended to reduce benefits. That's what it's all about. It's about cutting the benefits bill. In principle, there isn't necessarily anything wrong with having a single benefit, which is, you know, easy to understand, but universal credit clearly isn't working like that. And I have, you know, severe concerns about what's going to happen. I think we're going to see much higher levels of homelessness. We're going to see higher levels of poverty. Families are going to be hit in particular. This is not working.
Housing benefit is one of the most important benefits, and this is one of the reasons, as it's been turned into universal credit, that so many people have been evicted, because there's a different system for appealing against. Say, for example, the council decides they want to cut your housing benefit. It's a much longer process. Mm. In other words, they give you a long period of warning. You have the opportunity to reply. I had to do this myself, but you get about 2 months or so to say, well, look, you know, you need to send in this evidence. With universal credit, it's not like that at all. It just goes instantly. Mm. That can mean you're actually out on the streets within weeks.
Mm. Absolutely. And council officers are quite concerned about it, actually. Because believe it or not, people who work in these areas do care about the people they deal with. And
well,
they want to do best for them.
In
you
the
know,
housing associations,
and they're
I've
very worried
too, yeah.
about the implications of it. So, yes, I'm very concerned.
Anyway, it came up, the implication for food banks came up on the good old BBC Question Time with, I want to see Martin Summers on that panel, because we don't get anybody who's a sort of intellectual left type at all, apart from we get the odd comedian like Will Self or somebody, but there's a massive swathe of people who know a lot of stuff that they never have on there. In fact, we even had, didn't we, Dimbleby last week saying some complete nonsense about the British owned Siemens. He said, oh, Siemens is a British owned company. Dimbleby, wakey wakey, it's German. Everybody knows that, but he didn't. I mean, maybe this is some sort of propaganda myth that circulates around the BBC, because the Siemens have got a lot of BBC contracts. But anyhow, let's have a listen to Question Time last night on food banks. This was right at the very end, the very last two questions. Why is it that they only managed to get the really good points across 5 seconds before the end?
If I'm going into work and I lie to my business, I'm going to get sacked. The only way that you MPs get sacked is if you go on holiday to Israel.
I'll just say one more point from the woman in pink.
I think it's absolutely disgusting in this day and age that there are food banks at all. We should be looking after each other as decent human beings should. If it takes less money for certain people to make it better for other people, that's what should be happening. We should be looking after each other.
Thank you very much.
Well, obviously, I do agree with that. That's all I can say. I mean, we over a generation, we've lost the plot, haven't we?
Wasn't there something about World War II that actually brought this whole welfare state about, where we sort of thought, well, actually, if everyone's fighting and everyone's dying, or a lot of people are dying, that we need to make sure that we're looking after each other? It was something like that, wasn't it, that brought about the welfare
state? Let me ask you a question, Tony. What do you think the top rate of tax was in this country, in the United States of America, in the 1950s? Have a guess.
Top rate of tax. 90%?
95%. And it's now 40%. That's what we can't afford
actually,
to do stuff.
It doesn't matter how... You could have 90% now, but all the money's squirreled away in David Cameron's father's tax havens.
Yeah. So we're a much wealthier society than we were in those years, but we can't do what we did then, because we've changed our attitude.
Esther, we've had the... sorry. Oh, gosh.
Please.
Estella. Estella Ticknell, you're the Labour councillor for... we've had the 70th anniversary of the National Health Service as well, so we're talking about the welfare system and the NHS.
Yeah.
Many people say both actually under assault at the moment.
They are indeed under assault, that's for sure. And it seems to me if we could afford a National Health Service in the late 1940s when we've been devastated by war, we can afford a decent National Health Service now. It's as simple as that. We can choose what we spend our money on. And should I say, I'm a child of a National Health Service in a very special way. I mean, I was born with club feet and I had to have orthopaedic surgery on my feet, which my parents could never have afforded if we hadn't had, you know, a proper health service. And all of that was free. And I'm constantly grateful that I grew up in a society where that was considered to be right and proper. And I worry that we're now eroding that belief, actually, especially with regard to food banks. Once you normalise things like that and say, oh, food banks are simply part of the way things operate, then you've eroded a really important part of our sense of who we are and our commitment to a decent welfare state.
OK, back to the Prime Minister's questions where the NHS came up.
In the week of a special birthday for him and in the name of encouraging a young member as he seeks to build his career, I call Mr. Stephen Pound. Mr. Speaker, may I, in respect of the Prime Minister's opening statement, declare an interest, as I, too, was born in the first week of July 1948. And whereas I recognise that the National Health Service is held in rather higher esteem in the nation than I am, we... need a bit of care and attention. May I tell the Prime Minister, what the NHS needs is not warm words, but cold cash. And I would willingly, happily, joyfully pay more in income tax to save the National Health Service. Would she?
Can I first of all wish the Honourable Gentleman a very happy 70th birthday this week? And can I say to him that he is held in very high esteem across this House, and he should not underestimate it. May I also... Yes, that may not have done very well for him with his front bench, I'm afraid, for me saying that, but there we are. Can I also, Mr. Speaker, take this opportunity, as I haven't had one previously, to say I wish a very happy birthday for his birthday on Monday of my right honourable and learned friend, the Member for Rushcliffe. And can I, in answer to the issue that the Honourable Gentleman raised in his question, I think that what we are doing for the National Health Service is providing it with that money, ensuring that by 2023-24 it will have £20 billion extra in real terms, and ensuring alongside that a 10-year plan is produced which delivers for patients.
Well, Estella, what she's saying there is actually we're dealing with the problems, we're making sure it's properly funded.
Well, they always say that, don't they? But we know that's not the case, because waiting times have increased. We're seeing, you know, the problem of people waiting on trolleys in corridors. Oh, GP surgeries are struggling. GPs are leaving the service because they can't cope with the kind of pressures placed on them. And really the biggest issue that we all have to address is an ageing population. And there is absolutely nothing wrong with getting older. We need to make sure, you know, we're all getting older all the time. We need to make sure that we care for older people in an appropriate way. And at the moment, the relationship between social care and the health service is not being resolved. So you're finding people are going into hospital because they're old and are suffering from you know, a range of problems which are caused by old age, when they'd be much better off being cared for in their own homes with a decent social care service.
I do wonder, though, if the health service, Martin, can last another 70 years. What do you think?
Well, I think it's fairly clear that the plan by the deep state in the US and so on is to privatise the health service. That's why we had the Tory chap
Steve
on last
Smith
week.
Steve Smith was on last week.
Yeah. Who works in it for, you know. And I thought it was absolutely brass neck. He came and said, well, he's a private businessman who's contracted to the health service to manage it. At the same time, he said it's not being privatised. It's like, well, you didn't exist 10 years ago. Mm-hmm. And there you are. A private businessman working for the National Health Service.
It is being privatised by the back door, actually.
Can you just explain what you mean by that?
Well, for example, certain kinds of services are being provided by private companies. Now, of course, it's paid for by the NHS. So our money is going straight into the profits of those companies, basically. And they're doing that with the argument that, well, we don't actually have a resource in the National Health Service, so we're going to pay that company to do the job for you. But that's a way of actually opening the door to private services. It's still free at the point of delivery, but what's happening behind that isn't the principles of the health service as we understand it.
Well, I was sent up to Emerson's Green for some treatment. Mm. I walked in there and I felt like I was being, I don't know, it was very unprofessional. And I just said, no, I don't want this treatment, thank you very much. Wouldn't sign any of the forms, and I went and got it somewhere else. There is actually a qualitative difference, isn't there, Martin? Maybe you can answer this, between the way the NHS operates and the way a private business operates, because there is actually this profit motive, which means they're bound to want to cut costs.
Well, as a socialist, I also believe in top-down planning. The idea that local people know best what to do and all the rest of it. The National Health Service was designed to be top-down planned, and that's why it's efficient compared to other systems. And I'm afraid I'm not a green. I believe in top-down planning.
So do you think, Martin, another 70 years, yeah?
I think politically, the government have already run up the white flag by saying they're going to find 20 billion for it. Meanwhile, of course, Gavin, whatever his name is, the Defence Secretary, he wants another 20 billion for the armed forces because we're going to go to war with Russia, etc.
Yeah. Also, another story this week, children aged 12 arrested for dealing hard drugs as the county sees a shocking rise in juvenile cases. Now, this is in Liverpool. This is really picking up on our little row we had last week, Martin, about very young people being recruited into drug gangs. Merseyside Police, this is actually up in Liverpool. Records show that 70 children aged 17 or under were arrested in 2017, up from half that number in 2015. Of those young dealers, 18 arrested last year were aged 15 or under. The youngest person arrested was 12 years old, and five children aged 13 or under were arrested. Now, looking at the and I'll put a link to this on our show page if anyone wants to check. This is the BBC's recent article last few days talking about violent crime being recorded by the police, and it shows an absolutely enormous increase from around mid-2014, 2015. It's just starting to go right up. And that graphic I'll put up on our show page at thisweek.org.uk. Now, Estella, what worries me most here is that the drug dealers aren't stupid. They know that if a child of 11, 12, 13 years old is arrested, it's actually a lot more complex process for the police to deal with that through the juvenile courts. Mm. And so they would much prefer to have someone it's going to be difficult for the police to deal with actually doing those deals for them.
Sure. And using bicycles very often as well to kind of nip through the traffic and get to places. Yeah, it's very concerning.
But it's a complete exploitation of young people.
It is. It's very concerning. Yeah.
What would you do about it?
Well, that's a really difficult question. That's a $64 million question in some ways, you know.
But okay, all right. Well, maybe an easier question might be, what's the cause of this?
The causes are complex. I'm sure that poverty is one of the main causes. Social deprivation, clearly. Lack of proper drugs education. And, you know, a kind of fragmentation of society, actually. Not to put too fine a point on it.
Well, in actual fact, of course, we need to legalise drugs. I mean, Obrador has just won the election in Mexico. And, of course, he's not going to be allowed to legalise drugs, although that's what people want there. And ultimately, that's what's got to happen. In the Scandinavia in the 1930s, they didn't ban alcohol. But even today in Norway, you can only buy alcohol in government-run shops. And so what you do is you just nationalise and legalise and nationalise the whole thing.
What's the difference between legalising and decriminalising?
Well, in Portugal, they've decriminalised drugs about 10, 15 years ago, and that's worked really well. So people, for personal use, you're allowed to have anything. But, of course, it still leaves the market in the hands of the criminals. I mean, and, of course, the criminals are running the banking system. HSBC was done for running this money through. And put Philip Green, instead of, he should have been sent to prison, they pay a fine, and he's then appointed by David Cameron to be his advisor on tax.
The Daily Express is also pointing out that police numbers in London have plummeted to their lowest for 12. They've been building up slowly and slowly for 20 years as the population was going up, Estella. They're now right back to levels they were 20 years ago.
Yeah, but the other problem is if you criminalise people when they're young, then you set them on a path for, you know, a kind of a career criminal.
Okay, time for the Murdoch News at 7. Thanks to our guests, Labour councillor for Lockleys, Estella Ticknell, and her favourite film. Check it out. It's called Some People, made in 1962. Join us after the news as we do our best to keep ahead of the curve when we go to visit Amesbury.
Every hour, live from the Sky News Centre.